Hi, this is Manton Reese.
And this is Daniel Jalkett.
And this is Core Intuition, stubborn about great things.
Manton Reese, I was so excited when Apple announced iCloud Drive because it seemed to me, and probably would seem to most reasonable people, technical or otherwise, that iCloud Drive, implying a drive, i.e. something you put stuff on, would be like a volume on your Mac, right? Like something that you mount, like similar to a zip drive or a hard drive.
Or a previous service that they had called iDisk, which was exactly that, right? Like a web dev volume that mounted in the Finder.
Yep. I even went so far on a previous Core Intuition, I think, to suggest, oh, this is very interesting because it seems as though iCloud Drive will be the bridge that allows non-Mac App Store apps to take advantage of iCloud, right? Like, it would make sense. Like, oh, I love Apple and I support Apple so much that I've been building apps for them for decades. For that reason, I have legacy customers to support outside the Mac App Store, but wouldn't it be great to just like leverage all the greatness that Apple provides to us and be able to share that with all the good people who have bought from the Mac App Store and give them all of their files in one place? It would be very Dropbox-like and users would have total control over the files, but developers would be able to leverage it and make it great. And I thought that time was coming with iCloud Drive. And I've just heard a few things recently that, frankly, I hadn't even considered the possibility that it could be this negative. But the gist of what I've heard, Manton, and I haven't verified this, and this is all sort of like outside the scope of NDA access to any pre-released Apple software. But what I've heard, what I've had suggested to me is, in fact, it is not a drive. It is not a volume mounted on your Mac. It is instead a special way that apps that are permitted to access iCloud can, you know, access and store files in the usual hierarchical structure that drives have typically conveyed to users. But the point being, Finder will be one of those blessed apps. And of course, for 95% or more of users, the Finder being able to display its access to iCloud in the form of a drive will look like a drive. But only other apps, I think, if what I'm hearing is true, only other apps, unfortunately, that have those same credentials, those same Mac App Store-based provision, you know, whatever, what do you call them?
Entitlements.
Entitlements, yes.
Not that I would know anything about shipping Mac App Store apps.
Yes. Well, but that's the gist of it, is I thought this was going to be a great opening into iCloud, because something that we've been griping about, and lots of users, lots of developers have been griping about since iCloud launched, which is it's great for, well, first of all, it's great when it's not for core data syncing, right? But it's great unless you're using ensembles. But it's a great idea to allow all of your users to sync all of their data across an Apple-supplied and supported central repository. But if you can't actually offer that to all the app makers that users depend upon, then the attractiveness of that proposition is greatly diminished.
Well, and also since Dropbox became so popular on iOS, it seems like everyone's been waiting for Apple to kill it or replace it, or, you know, and famously Apple tried to buy Dropbox and there was the whole Steve Jobs, you know, you're a feature, not a product, you know, famous quote. And Dropbox, of course, has gone on to be even bigger and obviously a product and huge, and I depend on it heavily. But people seem, oh, every time Apple does something, they say, oh, now this is the, you know, this is replacing Dropbox, or this is just as good, and now I just use my Apple ID. And then we always have to be slightly disappointed, or happy, depending on your perspective, that it's not that. And I certainly was with you. I thought this was going to be closer to Dropbox, definitely mounted in the Finder. And the screenshots on the sort of preview pages for iOS 8 and Yosemite have a Finder window that looks like a normal Finder window. So you just assume that it is. But as you're saying, maybe it's not. Maybe it's this. It's kind of special to the Finder. And if you launch a Mac app, that does not support iCloud and you say, like, go to the open dialog, for example, maybe you don't see the iCloud stuff.
And this is skirting the NDA a little bit, but hey, Apple's being cool about this stuff recently.
I've got all this in beta now.
It's all in beta. So I feel comfortable saying, Manton, that when I heard about this, it sort of occurred to me, well, I've been running Yosemite for months now. I, for some reason, have never been compelled or tempted even to click that little button in the Finder that says iCloud Drive.
Such an important feature you're looking for.
It just didn't occur to me that I might actually want to click that. Hearing about this, I clicked it and it said, oh, this is cool. All you got to do is upgrade to iCloud Drive. Oh. And I thought, oh, well, that's weird. So I say, okay, upgrade me to iCloud Drive. I'm ready. I want to experience the best that Apple has to offer. And it takes me to the system preferences pane, to iCloud system preferences, whereupon it says, shows me a big list of iCloud services with all the checkboxes next to them. And iCloud is there, or iCloud Drive rather is there, and it's unchecked. And I check it and it says, okay, cool. So, if we enable this, none of your other iCloud apps on any of your devices, phones, iPads, etc., are going to be able to access iCloud anymore.
Nice. Wow.
Unless they upgrade to iOS 8.
Got it. Yeah.
So I was like, oh. It was like kind of like, okay, iOS 8 or Yosemite can access iCloud Drive. But worse than that, I guess, is if you quote-unquote upgrade your iCloud account, you can't, it's like, I don't know what that implies. It implies almost like a completely different technology stack, right?
That's exactly what it says to me. Like, maybe they have just a completely parallel, server farm and everything. And maybe it's really a next generation iCloud. And of course, they're building all the new photo stuff on top of this. They're building they're building iCloud Drive and the new photo stuff on top of CloudKit. But maybe that is all a new stack. And when you switch over to it, you kind of need to switch everything. I don't know. We're making stuff up, but that seems plausible to me. And I like it because, famously, iCloud has not worked 100% reliably. So if they do have a new stack, of course, there could be all sorts of new bugs. But maybe they've, this is the several generations into this technology. Maybe they've got it right. They really nailed it.
Well, I think going back to the Steve Jobs quote, I think that Steve Jobs quip about it's a feature, not a product, or not a service, whatever he said. Denigrate his quote without even knowing what it was. But
I think it was product.
It's an example of him at his worst, really, because right. It's like, okay, sometimes he said those quippy things and he turned out to be totally right.
Well, and he says them with such authority that it's like, I'm sure the founder of Dropbox, if you probably kind of did a take and was
probably,
like,
yeah, second guess.
Right? Yeah. Like, is my whole company doom.
So here's my take on it, Manton. It is a feature, not a product, but it's a feature upon which a product can be built, right? And that's what Dropbox is proving. Mm-hmm. I think they're sort of going back to our sad friends at app.net. I don't know if they're sad. I'm sad for them. Back to our friends at app.net, they sort of took the same approach. They started with a feature, which is an open developer API for social network data storage, socially networked data storage, right? Is that a fair summary?
I would say they start with a platform without a feature, but for the sake of argument, I'm going to go along with what you said.
Okay. Well, the point being, well, because I think the reason I make the comparison is because in many ways, actually, Dropbox is a platform. Maybe I don't want to go there. Okay. But it's like the kind of deal where it's like you start with something simple that maybe is just shrug it off as a feature. But as you see now with Dropbox, they got this stuff like Mailbox coming. They've got like their sites are higher than just a box you put your files in.
Oh yeah, they have big vision for it. Yeah, Mailbox, also the carousel, all the photo stuff.
Right, all the photo stuff. So it sort of like starts with a. It's funny because it's kind of like it's quote unquote just a feature. This like Dropbox, like put your files in a folder and you can have access to them anywhere. but it's a feature that Apple has yet to achieve. And that's mm-hmm. why, that's one of the areas where Steve Jobs' quip falls down, is if it's just a feature and it's a feature that's so valuable to people that you're being asked for your opinion about it, then why, you know, why can't Apple achieve it? And even with iCloud Drive, they won't have achieved it. And can you imagine, let's just say it's starting to sound like iCloud Drive, of course, will be available only to iOS 8 and Yosemite. And furthermore, people don't even have the choice of using iCloud Drive while maintaining whatever iCloud benefits they enjoyed before. I mean, like if you have an app that takes advantage of iCloud from an iOS device that can't run iOS 8, you got to like make that choice sometime. Like, do I want to still have my to-do lists available to me on my phone? Or do I want to use iCloud Drive? And can you imagine Dropbox, this quote-unquote just a feature company, can you imagine them saying, good news, starting with Dropbox 2.0, whatever it is, I don't know if they have versions, Dropbox next gen is going to be so great, it's going to improve everything. Just a little snag, you can't access your Dropbox from Mac OS 9 or earlier.
Right.
Right?
Unthinkable. And that's part of Dropbox's success, is that it's just so pervasive. It works so well. It's so fast. They never have little hiccups like that. You don't have to even worry about it.
Yeah.
It's such a great service. This might not be too bad, because when thinking back on the Finder, if you have an app that's document based, you should still be able to have files stored there, and you could like double click on them in the Finder and your app would open, and that, you know, you should be able to do that kind of stuff, right? Or do you think, that's got to work.
That's got to work, but how does the file get there in the first place?
Right. Yeah, I mean, you'd save it to the desktop and then you'd copy it to the right place in the Finder. I mean, it's clunky, but it seems like there's only so much they can hide from non-Mac App Store apps. Just like some parts of iCloud, I know PhotoStream is like that. If you dig deep enough in the library, application support, container, whatever folder, you know, you can find some of the stuff that's synced and you can mess with it just in the Finder on a Mac. Yeah. So there's only so much they can do, I think, on a Mac to completely hide this from apps.
I just had a revelation. all that negativity I've had since minute one of this podcast may have been ill-advised.
Okay.
Because I came into this podcast...
complete reversal.
I came into this podcast, guns blazing, right? Saying, I've never even looked, but if this is true, I'm right. angry.
Because it's faster to record a podcast than actually look.
Well, and that aforementioned like Rosemary's Baby choice about whether to turn on iCloud Drive made me... Mm-hmm. Unable and unwilling to test it for myself.
Right.
Here's the deal, Manton. I was thinking all along, like, okay, this sucks because now no apps are going to be able to access iCloud Drive. And then when you said that thing about, well, what if you happen to have a file in there that's associated with your app? I thought, as I said a few minutes ago, I said, well, how does it get there? And then it occurred to me, the file saving mechanism that Mac apps use in a sandboxed environment, at least, is not the app doesn't write the file. I think it's the power box.
The power box thing. Yeah, you're right. And it can temporarily, you know, poke holes to save things in places that your app shouldn't be able to write to.
And so maybe that's, I don't know. This might have been a lot of speculation about nothing. We'll find out.
Yeah.
But
well, it's interesting. I mean, it's part of this evolving. Can Apple get sync right?
And
iCloud, is it flaky? Is it perfect? There's some good stuff in iOS, though, as I was thinking about this. On the iOS side of the new iCloud stuff, there's iCloud Drive, which is great because apps can open documents from other apps without being completely, you know, siloed and totally separate. And iOS apps, of course, are used to being sandbox, they're used to being sold in the app store, so this is not really a new complaint for that. But there's also the storage containers thing. Do you remember this? So I think it was labeled under enterprise-y features, but I assume it's for everybody, where in the document picker, and again, I haven't actually used any of this, but on iOS, when you open a file, you can choose, if you have a storage extension or whatever they're called, to open files from something that's not iCloud Drive. Like in the demo, they showed Box.net and Microsoft's OneDrive as examples. Dropbox, I assume, could plug into that too. So it's interesting. Like on one hand, maybe they're being more restrictive on the Mac side, but on the iOS side, it opens things a lot wider than they were before.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, Manton, one of these days you and I should learn of which we speak. Of what we speak? Well, we should also learn which cliche to adopt and how to present it accurately. What do you think?
Fair enough, yeah. Okay, this week we are sponsored by Crashlytics again. Crashlytics is a reporting framework for iOS, Mac, Android, and it started with just crash reporting, so you could look through your crash log and see where your crashes were happening. And now basically does three things, and they're all very cool, very well done. There's the crash reporting part, there's beta distribution, so getting your iOS app, shipping it to people's computers. And then there's also this new Crashlytics Answers, this analytics service where you can say, you know, who's using my app right now, you know, how many people are not crashing, which is something I've talked about before. I really like the crash-free sort of graph and stats about how your app is performing. And then have other stats about how long people are using the app, what versions they're on. So it's really a good way to kind of just drill into how your app is being used and what versions and what OSs are being used. So those are the three things. The crash reporting is still really great, and that's where they started. And then they do beta distribution and also this answers part of the product too. And it's all still totally free, so you can check it out at crashlytics.com.
Yeah, Manton, you know, this there's something new actually with the beta testing thing. I think when Apple announced at WWDC that they were going to run with their test flight acquisition and like offer a beta testing solution of their own, you know, some people were probably like, oh, what does this mean for Crashlytics and other beta testing services? And my initial reaction was, well, I'll tell you what's going to happen is what happens every time Apple makes a move somewhere it's just about every time anyway. They make a move into some third-party product field, and then they just don't do a complete solution, and all of the third parties like come in and they do this innovation to make the product even better, and it ends up making what Apple has to offer look weak by comparison. And there's some news from Crashlytics recently about their beta testing feature, which is a new groups functionality. This is a great idea. I have this conundrum when I do my own beta testing, historically on the Mac. It's like you want to, basically when you're doing beta testing, you want to get the product into as few hands as you can that will result in the most valuable feedback. So sometimes that means really you'd like to have just like your inner circle of 10 testers who you know kind of like really hammer at it and give you great feedback. You want to, ideally for some builds, you'd just like to have them take a look at it and get the stuff that, you know, is going to be really embarrassing to have a larger beta testing group check out. So in a nutshell, groups from Crashlytics for their beta testing service allows you to set up this exact kind of thing where you can have a list of people from your testing group that you label with a specific name. And then when you release a build, you can say, you know what, this one just goes to my A-team testers. And then when they come back and they say, you know what, this is looking pretty good, then you can say like, all right, let's send this other build out to the to the worldwide, like everybody who we have ever tested an app with list. And I think this is a great example of innovation that Apple's going to have trouble keeping up with. And kudos to Crashlytics for continuing to improve this beta testing product. As Manton said, you can learn more about the beta testing tool and everything else Crashlytics has to offer at crashlytics.com. And folks, we want to thank Crashlytics. They've been sponsoring us now for, I think, Manton, over 2 years. They've been a very great long-term sponsor of Core Intuition. I know a lot of you who listen to the show have learned about Crashlytics from our show and the fact that we talk about all the great features it has to offer. So if you end up using Crashlytics and it changes your development life, Do us a favor and send them a tweet or something at Crashlytics. Let them know that you appreciate their sponsorship of the show. We sure appreciate that their sponsorship of the show. And they've been a great support to us here at Core Intuition. Thanks again. Once again, folks, that's Crashlytics.com. Manton, I have a long time reputation as being an anti-fan of Git.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I can still remember back when I was a Subversion user and I got the news that, you know, you should pick something that's a distributed version control system. And I'm like, what the heck is a distributed version control system? And now, of course, it seems obvious. But back then it was like, blows my mind. Like, of course, you just have like a repository in one place and it's called Subversion because it's the best thing that ever happened because it's better than CVS, which is better than RCS. And that was like my worldview of version control at that time. And then it occurred to me, apparently I'm supposed to pick something new. And I spent probably a year going like, okay, well, now I have that paradox of choice problem because there are three really widely respected version control systems.
I've already forgot the third one.
You're about to remember it. So I'll start with that one.
Okay.
Bazaar.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
B-A-Z-A-A-R. I think the command line tool name was B-Z. It was clearly the third runner in the top three, and that explains probably why it has more or less fallen off the radar. And I think that was from Canonical. I think it was from the Ubuntu people.
Okay.
Does that sound right? I don't know. We'll find out. Listeners.
It's a blur now. I remember the name and not much else.
Email Marco. But Bazaar, it was one of them. Mercurial was another one, which is a version control system very similar to Git, but with a few different choices in the user interface and in the sort of famously in the branching approach. And it had this interesting, attractive sort of to me feature of being written all in Python or you know, for the most part in Python.
Mm-hmm.
And then Git, of course, which was at the time not a clear leader. So right. this is the conundrum. I was actually faced with this problem. At the time, I believe it was only even slightly clear that Bazaar was the odd one out. It was like I remember sitting down and thinking, I need to pick one of these. Bazaar, Git, or Mercurial. I had no preference for either of them. In fact, the first thing I did when evaluating which one to choose was I looked at Subversion, my old trusty friend. Subversion, which is an open source product with a BSD MIT style license, which had in fact facilitated me using Subversion on behalf of a client for like a clever kind of project that didn't have to be open sourced. And I looked at the three and I said, well, maybe I'll just pick the one that has a sane open source license, but they're all GPL.
Whoops. <Yeah.
laughs> So I'm like, okay, well, which of these crappy GPL products am I going to use? At some point I ended up, I think getting somebody more tuned in gave me the signal like, hey, Bazaar, it's not happening. And that was good advice because as we see today, it's not happening.
Yep.
And then I don't know why, to be honest, Manton, I ended up going with Mercurial. Perhaps I liked the name. Perhaps it matched my personality. Perhaps I liked the fact that with its Python implementation, you could write plugins in Python that just dynamically added to the functionality of the tool. And I don't think GitHub may not have existed yet when I made this choice, which is terrifying to think of.
Or early on enough that it wasn't clear that it was going to go anywhere
right.
or be any bigger than any other, you know, whatever the Bazaar popular web front end was, GitHub could have just been that at the time.
Right, right.
Yeah. Well, also, you famously said that, I don't know famously, but you've often said that Mercurial has a better, more user-friendly command line interface. Like, it makes a little more sense get the commands. I mean, once you get used to them, I guess they're not that bad, but it's taken me years.
Like, oh yeah.
It was a huge learning curve compared to Subversion. Part of that is the complexity of distributed version control, but part of it is just like, it's kind of arcane and kind of messed up the way they do things.
Well, you can tell how screwed up Git is because the defenders of Git, whenever you complain about it, the 99% of the people who defend Git defend it by saying, once you learn
right
all about its internal implementation, you will not find it so confusing.
Once you read the source code, which is not Python, it's just straight C probably.
Right. Written by a crazy Linux kernel founder.
Right.
And I'm thinking like, so if I just learn all about the internals of Git, then I will learn why, you know, something that I can access with one like meaningful, you know, verb name in Mercurial. Here's the problem with Mercurial. You can't say the name. At least I can't.
HG is the
HG. It's terrible. I've been supporting this danged version control system for years, unable to say its name.
Mm-hmm.
Mercurial.
Yep.
The problem with Mercurial is, what was I going to say? Oh, the problem with it is that it has command names that make sense. And then you go to Git and they say, it's not a problem. You just
write a shell script that wraps the three commands right. that you want to do.
You say Git, there's a special command you have to know, which goes straight to the Git commit database. And once you pipe that through sed and awk, that's basically how talking to a Git apologist works.
I thought you were going to say, you know, just use a graphical user interface, Mac app or something.
Oh, that's the other thing. You're right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. This gets my goat, too. It's the other people. You're right. Those are the two extremes. The one extreme is everything you're complaining about would not be a problem if you just learned every single implementation detail of Git and learned to think like Linus Torvalds.
That was not right. Of the five ways to pronounce his name, you picked the sixth one.
So anyway, that's choice number one. And choice number two is just use Git X or Tower.
Right. And of course, I took that advice and I picked the wrong client. Like I use the command line for some stuff. And then for the last year or two, I've been using Gitbox, which I love. It's a great Mac app. But unfortunately, it is not supported anymore. And it works 95% of the time. It works beautifully. I love the workflow. I love the way he's thought about the app. It's very simple. And I'd still recommend it, I guess. But unfortunately, I don't think it's going to see any new version because it hasn't had one in forever. And I'm pretty sure that it's just kind of unsupported. And I hit a couple snags with it every once in a while. And so where we're leading up to, I'm about to get there with GitHub and Git. But last week I also switched to Tower. And you know, I heard so many good things about the 2.0 version of that. And I for a long time I was using kind of a more obscure one. I guess it's not as popular as the other ones, but I'm going to miss it because I really loved the design that he came up with for the app.
Well, I actually use yet another one, which I'm sure you're familiar with, which is SourceTree,
mm-hmm.
Which is, I like to say that it's open source quality software that's not open source.
Okay.
It's like everything about it is kind of like clunky enough that you would think this thing should probably be open source. Where do I get the repository so I can fix this? But then it's not actually open source. But it's free. So I guess it became free at some point. And it has enough power. Here's the thing, though. The only reason I use SourceTree is because of Git. And SourceTree is notably a tool that supports Mercurial and Git.
Oh, that's nice.
But I was never inspired to use a GUI client before having to use Git.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's not entirely true. Every once in a while, I would run into something where I was like, you know, this would be visually easier to handle, like if I just need to review a bunch of diffs in a row and if it's something I couldn't pipe into file merge or something. But come along with Git, and I'm a reasonably intelligent person who has experience with a distributed version control system that I have learned fairly well. And like a lot of people, when I complain about Git, they say, well, you just need to learn about acyclical, directed graphs. And, if you just understood how to branch and fork, and I'm like, I understand that stuff. It's just Git makes it comically impossible to do.
Well, it's kind of like Git is kind of low level, and it's almost begging for, like, many, many people don't even really use the main Git commands. They adopt like the Git flow workflow, which is kind of almost a layer on top of it. You know, I mean, it's not really new commands necessarily, although people do have scripts and you have apps that have Git flow, compatible features in them, whatever. But it's almost like a standard way of working with branches and repositories that it almost sits at like a higher level than the base stuff.
That's the third kind of problem I have then, Manton. Okay, the first was people who say you should just learn all the internals of the system. The second was people who say you should just use this high-level thing. And then the third one is just in general, people who assume that because I don't like and don't understand Git, that means I need some like remedial education on the overall notion of version control.
Right.
And so I usually like make these little quips on Twitter like, when am I ever going to learn Git? And they're like, oh, it's easy. Just, use this learning Git for dummies. And it's like, no, I want to learn how to use Git like an intelligent person who knows how to do like advanced things. So then that's when I'm like, okay, well, learn the internals, weirdo.
Read the code.
Yeah.
What are you waiting for?
Anyway, it's not like learning Mercurial has been a walk in the park. It's not like it's not like there haven't been lots of intellectual challenges along the way, and I still have a long way to go with a lot of version control concepts. Mm-hmm. But dang it all, Manton, that is one good. As far as these version control systems go, there are a lot. It's like somebody who wrote the user interface to Mercurial had used a Mac ever. Mm-hmm. And they appreciated this idea of sane defaults.
Right.
They appreciated this idea of, discoverability. And I don't get any of that from Git. And nobody seems to expect it. Or the people who become Git apologists, they stop faulting Git for that. It's like they fall into this... I even know like ex super fans of Mercurial who are now like, well, I don't know. I just think Git is pretty great now. And they've been zombified.
Well, here's there's good news and bad news. The good news is actually Git, the command line interface is getting better. I've noticed that like newer versions have some more commands, and you can imagine another couple of years goes by and some of the more arcane things, maybe there's like a single command that can do some of that stuff. Like, it's not like it's just standing still. I think that's good news. But
yeah, that is good news.
Here's the bad news. Yes. Game over. GitHub is so good.
Oh, God.
That it has taken over the world. Like, we talked a minute ago about how when it started, GitHub was either not there at all or it was just another website. But then it reached this tipping point, and it reached it years ago. This is not a new thing where, like, Ruby on Rails started using GitHub. I don't know, name some other open source project, right? Everybody started using it. And now millions of random open source projects you've never heard of are using it. And what happens, and what happened to me recently, is that you get sucked into using GitHub because it's so good. And other people, friends are using it, coworkers are using it, open source projects are using it. You basically cannot be a programmer and not use GitHub right now. It's almost impossible. Even if you're just browsing GitHub, even if you're not signed in, or even if you're doing just basic like forking a project or downloading code, you can't really get by without using it a little bit. And for a lot of people, me included, I use it all the time every day because I work with people that use it.
Yep.
And so what I finally realized is it just didn't make any sense anymore for me to have – first of all, I have, Subversion repository still, and then I have to switch between Subversion and Git. And then all my Riverfold, indie projects, all my private repositories are hosted somewhere else. That was a Beanstalk, which I've been using for 6 years and I loved. But at some point, it's like, okay, I have to use this server for this and then GitHub for this. And like last week, I said, you know what? It's time to simplify. And so I moved everything to GitHub. All my projects. I converted all my Subversion projects. I moved all my Git projects that were on Beanstalk. And I was really sad to say goodbye to the Beanstalk folks because I really think they did a great job with that product. But it just didn't make any sense anymore to just not have everything on GitHub. And Beanstalk, shout out to them too. Like, I still recommend them if you need Subversion and Git together. and you want something private that's separate. But actually the co-founder sent me an email when I left, you know, asking if there's anything, you know, they can do and to improve the product and thanks for being with them and all that kind of stuff. So I've always got a good feel from those people and it really hurt to cancel my account. But it just GitHub is so good. The features, the web interface, how pull requests work, just how fast it is. GitHub Issues is really good. And so many people use it. I felt like I was just kind of wasting time not moving all my stuff there. So I did.
Yep.
It sucks, man. And sorry. It's true, though. I use GitHub, and it's my first. It's the first place I think of when I think of sharing code. So all of my, I don't host anything at that place. I can't even remember the name of that. That does Mercurial hosting.
Bitbucket,
yes.
And if Fog Creek has a Mercurial.
And Fog Creek has, here's the thing. Fog Creek's thing has actually been my crutch sometimes because when I really want to work in Mercurial, Fog Creek's thing, Kiln, has this brilliant thing where it converts on the fly between Git and Mercurial. And they're so similar in some ways. Mm-hmm. You'd think that would be easy, but then they're so different in some specific ways that it was actually a great engineering accomplishment for them to achieve that.
Yeah.
But damn, I wish they would sell that technology to GitHub. And if GitHub could say, hey, you know, we're the best. We can serve Mercurial or Git if you must. then, you know, it would, I don't know. I know I'm dreaming here. I'm a dreamer, Manson.
I think it's too late for that.
I think it's game over. I think you're right.
I said some nice things about Beanstalk. They supported Subversion, Mercurial, and GitHub, and Git for a long time. And they just recently, I think, dropped Mercurial because it's just not popular enough.
Right.
And, I don't know. GitHub, it's really good. And, you know, I guess there's a little bit of a risk maybe that the company, I don't know, of all the internet companies out there, I mean, Dropbox, we talked about a bunch on this podcast. I think they're going to be around for decades. Some will come and go. I actually think GitHub, they may be around for a long, long, long time.
Well, they're a revenue-supported company, I think.
Well, they were, but then they wanted to expand and they took venture capital just a couple years ago. And they certainly have enormous amounts of revenue, but they also have a lot of investment now. So I think they're kind of borderline. Mm-hmm. I don't think they're actually as profitable as they used to be because they're trying to grow, but they certainly make a lot of money. I mean, I pay them $25 a month now as of a few days ago because I made a, you know, Riverfold organization on there and I have all my private repositories and, you know, they make a lot of money.
Yeah. Well, Manton, I'm glad you've managed to centralize on GitHub. It's like I said, I go there for everything I want to share. It's just I'm a little stubborn about great things. And that's why I'm a Mac user. You know, that's why I stuck with Apple through a decade of downtimes. And that makes it hard for me to leave Mercurial. And I'm not ready to leave Mercurial yet, but I am getting better at Git. And it can't hurt me. Once I know all the internals of Git, I'll probably turn into one of those Git zombies and I'll say, it's just easy to learn. What's wrong with you? But in the meantime, I'm going to keep using Mercurial for all my, you know, sacrosanct internal stuff. And then only that stuff I throw out to the masses can use that dirty Git language.
I don't know what the stubbornness you're talking about is. I'm
You've never witnessed that before.
Yeah. So how's Twitter going?
Twitter's pretty good. It's not the same without you, though, Manton. We know. We miss you.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening to the show this week. Thanks to our sponsor, Crashlytics. Check out the jobs board, too. We still have, for a few more days, a $100 half-off sale. If you want to post a job, get your job in front of a bunch of great Mac and iOS developers. That's at jobs.corent.org.
Thanks, everybody. See you next week, Manton.